Welcome to Going Beyond Medicine with Elaine Groman. Conversations with people who are working to make a difference in our world. Now here's your host for Going Beyond Medicine on Empower Radio, Elaine Groman.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Elaine Groman, and I am very honored to begin 2019 with the very important subject of human safety. And in particular, a brilliant woman by the name of Beverly Hill, who is the founder and president of an organization called Genderside, the Genderside Awareness Project. For those of you who are not aware that January is Human Trafficking Awareness Month, and human trafficking is a big umbrella term that talks about many ways that human beings are, in the most brutal way to say it, eliminated. Socially eliminated, physically eliminated, culturally eliminated from our human species. And so today I am honored to have a conversation with Beverly. Thank you so much for your time today, Beverly.
Hello, Elaine.
Hi. Please, first of all, tell us a little bit about yourself, and so that we can begin to understand, where did this knowledge and subject of Genderside touch you so that you decided to bring it to the world for, you know, to exhibit it as you have?
Certainly. In my adult life, I have spent three decades, each decade doing something different. During the first 10 years, I was in academics. I taught history and history of science. During the second decade, I retrained to do something I'd always wanted to do, even though it was completely impractical. I retrained as a sculptor, a figurative sculptor. And for a decade, I produced figurative bronzes and also ceramic wall hangings. So those were landscapes and figures as well. And it was during that period that I read an article that came out in 2004, written by a wonderful, very courageous journalist named Peter Landesman. It appeared in the magazine section of the New York Times, and it was called The Girl on Main Street, or The Girl Next Door, not The Girl on Main Street. Which was really not a good title for it. It was about sex trafficking. And Peter Landesman was one of the first journalists to really break open these global sex trafficking rings. In 2004, we had no idea. It's hard to imagine that now because it's been in the news so much since then, and there are so many nonprofits that deal with it. But in 2004, we had no idea that these global rings existed. We had no idea of the scale of the problem. And there were some very courageous journalists like Peter who risked their lives to almost penetrate these rings and document what was occurring. And in this article that he wrote, there were vignettes and photos, and there was one particular photo and one particular vignette that really moved me. The photo was one that he took, again, risking his life from the top of a building. He was on the roof of a low building, and he was shooting down into an alley, so it was an overhead shot. And the shot was of a girl still in her school uniform, if I recall correctly. She looked to be maybe 14 years old. And she was standing, her head was down. She seemed to know that something awful was going on. And around her was a semicircle of about 10 men who were bidding on her, you know, and this was modern day slavery. This wasn't a slave auction. And I was so shocked, absolutely flabbergasted that that type of thing was occurring. And my heart just went out to this girl. You know, here she was freshly kidnapped and being sold to a brothel.
And where was this taking place, Beverly?
It was somewhere in Latin America. Okay. I would have to look at the article again to get the exact location.
Thank you.
Could have been Mexico, could have been some other Latin American country. The story that touched me so deeply was the story of a girl who was brought from Asia, I believe it was, to a brothel in, again, I think it was Latin America. But the key part of the story was that she arrived not speaking the language. Her papers and documentation had been taken from her. She was completely dependent on her captors, and her life was confined to this brothel. And slowly she began to get the lay of the land. Again, she did not speak the language. She couldn't read and write, even in her own country, let alone in this foreign language. And she figured out where the police station was. And one afternoon, she had an opportunity to escape, and she took advantage of it. And she went to the police station, threw herself at their mercy. And because they were in collusion with the brothel owners, they returned her to the brothel, where she was savagely beaten as an example to the others and a warning to herself. And that story just broke my heart. Mm-hmm. You know, here was this girl with not a single person that she could turn to. The police were collecting protection money from the brothels. And when they weren't in uniform, they were frequenting the brothel. I was in a cafe reading this, and by this point I was sniffling, and this was back in the day of real paper newspapers, and I had this big New York Times. I was holding it up, shielding my face, because the tears were just streaming down my face. And I said to myself, there have been so many times when I've read about something so deeply disturbing like this, whether it was abuse of children or homelessness, or in this case, sex trafficking. And I said, you know, too many times I read about it, I write some checks, and then I seem to move on and forget about it. And I vowed to myself, this time I'm not going to do that. I am going to do something about this. But at that time, I had two young children. I really was not in a position to do very much. But I didn't forget the vow. I vowed that to myself, to God, to the universe. And I started educating myself about the situation of women globally. And then about 6 years later, after my 50th birthday, something clicked in my head and said, okay, it's time to get to work now. My children were about 11 and 14 at that point, 11 and 15, and less dependent on me, much more independent. And so I began casting about, interviewed with some organizations here in Dallas, where I live, about volunteering. There's one marvelous organization called Mosaic Family Services. It's an odd name, but one of the things they do is they provide shelter for trafficked women, not domestically trafficked women, but internationally trafficked women. Who don't have passports and don't have documentations and don't speak English and didn't grow up here and have all of these additional problems that a domestically trafficked woman would not have. But during my 6 years, I had learned about what is commonly called gendercide. It's not really the correct term. The correct term would be female genocide or sometimes femicide. But the term gendercide was coined by a scholar in the 1980s, Marianne Warren, and it took off. So we use it. That's the term that somebody is Googling on this topic. That's the term they're going to use. So that's what we used in our name. So I learned about gendercide, and I learned that at that time, over 100 million women were missing from the world population due to social causes, due to discrimination. This was a completely man-made atrocity, and it wasn't recognized as an atrocity. It was recognized as a population problem or a sex imbalance. And the human suffering that went along with this really was not recognized. This was an underreported issue, never, ever in the news. Slowly, some reports emerged about it. And these were reports in The Economist, for example, about sun preference, particularly in East Asia and South Asia and the Middle East. Sun preference resulting in the selective abortion of female fetuses in areas where that technology was available, the scanning technology and the abortion technology. And in areas where that technology was not available, girls were being killed directly after birth. So this had just trickled into the news. But this was just one component of gendercide. It is the largest component, the largest contributor to the loss of females worldwide. But the vanishing of older women, women over age 50, who do not manage to live out to their natural life expectancies, that was not in the news at all. That was that phenomenon could only be found in academic literature.
Beverly, let me stop you for a moment, if I may, because I was able to find that article. As you were speaking, I was looking up on Google, and Peter Landsman's article is called The Girls Next Door. And I just posted it on my Facebook page, ElaineGroman.com, or Elaine M. Groman on Facebook. So thank you for that, because I think that we need to be so aware that this is unfortunately something that has happened for centuries. And it is, yes, indeed, it seems to be a new phenomenon, but it isn't. And we need to be aware that if we are willing to allow half of humanity to become extinct, then we as a species will become extinct. And
that's quite true.
And
yes.
And what we need to begin to understand is there are many, many people that clearly know that this is happening. And many, many people who are complicit with keeping this information quiet. And so I thank you for what you're talking about. But I did want to let you know that I found that article.
Thank you.
And I do want to talk to you and continue to talk to you about what you're speaking about older women, the grandmother age, those ones that can use the wisdom of their experience to help to guide young women and protect young women and to educate them. If they were allowed to do so.
Yes, they play an important role in society. As you say, they often help their children with child rearing. It has been said, I can't remember the exact statistic, but it require one person cannot raise a child.
It takes a village, know,
and,
they say.
And raise and earn a living. Easily, or, you know, it generally requires more than one. And if the husband is not available, the grandmother becomes indispensable. And I'm speaking globally, not about the United States. So yes, those women are vitally important, in society. But their disappearance is also important because it's a personal tragedy for these women. The reason that they tend to vanish is that wealth and property and the means for earning a living, the material assets needed to earn money, are traditionally, in traditional societies, channeled through the males in the family. Mm-hmm. And quite often, women have no inheritance rights. They have no right to have their own bank accounts, to conduct transactions, to operate their own businesses. And the result is that when a woman loses her husband in one of these traditional societies, she does not inherit the wealth and the property, whatever wealth and property they enjoyed together. It was his, but she enjoyed it with him. It goes to the sons. And if there are no sons, she still doesn't get it. It goes to the brothers of her deceased husband. And you see this both in South Asia and in sub-Saharan Africa. And I have seen videos of the brothers of the deceased husband just coming in to a home and cleaning out everything. And the widow is thrown out and left to survive however she can. And she will do that by begging or by doing laundry. She's becomes a street person. If she's young, sometimes widows are very young, by prostituting herself, whatever she can do to survive. And this phenomenon is not reported in the news, and yet it is so widespread that we lose 1 million women per year over age 50 to social causes, to discrimination. That's a mind-boggling number.
It is.
And it is such a personal tragedy for these women. Their lives are so difficult. You travel in a third world country and you see older women begging in the streets. And you have to ask yourself, what circumstances brought her there?
Yes.
How did she end up in that position?
You know, I want to say, Beverly, I learned of you. I did not meet you firsthand, but a woman that I do know, Sandy Hart from the Charter for Compassion, showed us, and also Grandmother Flor de Mayo, I'm privileged to know, let me know of the incredible exhibition that you had at the Parliament of World Religions. Can you speak about that? Because it is, I'm looking at the video right now, and it is so viscerally impactful.
Thank you so much, Elaine. That exhibit demonstrates the scale of gendercide in a very moving and powerful way, visually powerful way. One of the tasks that our group has assigned ourselves is to take this information about gendercide, female genocide, if you prefer, out of the academic literature and try to raise awareness and educate the general public in a way that is not quite so erudite. So the art exhibit was a great way to do that. It's done with baby booties. We collected 12,600 pairs of handmade baby booties made all over the world. And each pair represents 10,000 missing women and girls.
Oh,
and
God,
we
chilling.
Arranged them. We attached them to long, clear plastic strips, you know, that had holes in them. And then we created a maze. So the art exhibit is a floor-to-ceiling maze of baby booties with a pathway carved out for visitors. It's baby booties from the floor up to 8 feet. And it fills 1,800 square feet, which would be the size of a very small house. 180 square meters for your international listeners. It's very powerful. The density of the baby booties increases as you go through so that you can't see outside the exhibit. The baby booties are so dense that you're blinded.
The photos are just staggering. And to think, you know, my own babies, holding my own little babies in my arms, and that precious life, to compound that by each one of those baby booties representing 10,000 is just beyond sickening.
Yes. We used sound in the exhibit as well. As you walk through at two or three points, you will hear the voices of women or girls in multiple languages. They'll cut on and then they'll cut off, and they're singing or they're chanting, they're laughing, they're talking. And that use of sound emphasizes the ephemeral nature of their lives, that their lives are really at risk of being cut off, just as their voices are cut off. The part of this that makes me proudest is that more than 90% of those baby booties were made by women in developing countries who are at risk themselves. We commissioned them from sewing cooperatives that had been created to help very poor women. And we paid the women fairly. We paid a fair price for their time and their labor. And we asked them, when possible, if at all possible, to use materials that were traditional to their cultures so that they could show off their handiwork and their artisanal traditions. And so the baby booties from Indonesia are made from batik cloth, and the ones from the Andes Mountains, we had several countries from the Andes Mountains, are made from aguayo cloth. And, you know, the ones from India were beautiful silk, and we had other gorgeous silk ones from Afghanistan. And we hit almost every continent, not Antarctica. Antarctica is not represented. And then women from wealthier Western countries donated baby booties. We also had a couple of men who created baby booties. But the idea here was that it be a global exhibit created by the women who are at risk for these atrocities, so that in some sense, we are giving them a voice to talk about their situation. So most people are very, very moved when they go through that exhibit. They initially, as they enter, the reaction is, oh my gosh, these are adorable. They're so cute. And or my gosh, how much work went into making these, because really each pair is made with so much attention to detail. We asked the women to make them as if they were making them for their own daughters, you know, and to express the love and the whimsy and the beauty and the attention to detail, the effort that they would have put into baby booties for their own daughters. So each pair is like a little work of art. And that's what initially attracts people's attention and what they respond to initially. But as they go through, and it turns, and there are more and more and more, and they're denser and denser, this sort of sickening sensation that you described sets in. I like to describe it as emotional dissonance. It's so beautiful, and yet the meaning is so terrible.
Yes.
So, and we accompany that with a lot of educational material. Well, not too much, but before you go through the exhibit, you see about 20 to 30 posters. It depends on how much room we have to display them, with basic information about basic statistics about the scope of the problem, information about the causes, the reasons for it, and about the social consequences, which are all unsavory.
Well, Beverly, I cannot thank you enough for what you're doing. And again, my guest is Beverly Hill. She is the president and founder of the Gendercide Awareness Project, which is a globally impacted organization that is helping us to understand that 126 million women and children are lost in our world. And they're lost through many ways, through, as Beverly so eloquently stated, through lack of care, disempowerment from their social environment, from selective genocide, etc. We do have to take a break, Beverly, and when we come back, I'd like to talk about the work that you're doing educating girls globally and what we can do to help to contribute to end this horrible problem. My name is Elaine Grohman. This is Going Beyond Medicine on Empower Radio. Please stay with us as we continue our conversation with Beverly Hill.
You're listening to Empower Radio, an entire radio station devoted to your personal development, expanding your conscious awareness, and empowering positive change. Meet our hosts and listen online at EmpowerRadio.com, on iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher Radio, or iTunes, or download the Empower Radio app for your smartphone or tablet. It's free in the App Store, and it lets you listen to our shows and podcasts on demand. Empowering people, empowering change. Empower Radio, online at EmpowerRadio.com.
Every 3 minutes, another woman gets the news that she has breast cancer. And here are some of the first words she hears. HER2 oncogene, aromatase inhibitor, ductal carcinoma in situ. What do these words mean? How are you going to decide what to do if you can't even say what you have? Listen to me, Shirley Jones. As soon as you get your diagnosis, go to breastcancer.org. It's a special place on the internet where you can learn how to say all those breast cancer words and find out what they mean. At breastcancer.org, you can learn more about your particular kind of cancer and your treatment options. Prepare a list of questions for your next doctor's visit and get all kinds of other useful information to guide you and your family through this. Breastcancer.org, the first place to go the minute you find out you have breast cancer.
Every 3 minutes, another woman gets the news that she has breast cancer. And here are some of the first words she hears. HER2 oncogene, aromatase inhibitor, ductal carcinoma in situ. What do these words mean? How are you going to decide what to do if you can't even say what you have? This is Olivia Newton-John. As soon as you get your diagnosis, you can go to breastcancer.org. It's a special place on the internet where you can learn how to say all those breast cancer words and find out what they mean. At breastcancer.org, you can learn more about your particular kind of cancer and your treatment options. Prepare a list of questions for your next doctor's visit and get all kinds of other useful information to guide you and your family through this. Breastcancer.org, the first place to go the minute you find out you have breast cancer.
What's your favorite color? Tell us, please.
Kids will spend 20 minutes listening to songs like this.
What's your favorite color? What's your...
How about 2 minutes to brush their teeth? Brushing for 2 minutes now can save your child from severe tooth pain later. For fun 2-minute videos to watch while brushing, visit 2min2x.org. 2 minutes twice a day. They have the time. A message from the Partnership for Healthy Mouths, Healthy Lives, and the Ad Council.
Empowering you for a better life.
This is Empower Radio.
Now back to Elaine Grohman and Going Beyond Medicine on Empower Radio.
EmpowerRadio.com.
Welcome back to the show. My guest today is Beverly Hill, who is the president of the Gendercide Awareness Project, a global program to help to educate us about the unbelievable problem and challenge that we have with human selective gendercide. Thank you. And let's continue our conversation, Beverly. Thank you for being on the show.
My pleasure, Elaine.
May I ask you, please, what is happening, Beverly, globally to educate girls? And obviously we have to educate more than girls, but those adults that are responsible for the care of these girls, but obviously when they're able to understand the complexity of this information, how do we help them to be safe?
Well, our organization believes that education is the best long-term strategy for ending this problem of gendercide. There are two basic reasons that parents in traditional societies have a strong preference for sons. And the first, and this does relate to education. I am answering your question. I'm just taking the long route to get there.
No, you're great. Thank you.
The first is the belief that a girl will not help support her parents in older age. And that applies both to financial support and traditionally even to assistance. Traditionally, a girl would marry a young man from a family far outside her village. Obviously, they didn't want too much intermarriage within a village. So couples were picked from far-flung villages. And a girl would go and live with her new husband in his home, in his village, with his parents. The generations lived together. And because in order to prevent too much intermarriage, he had to live far away, it meant that it was almost impossible for her ever to return to her own family. The distances were great and the transportation was extremely difficult and expensive. And so she really left her own biological family and became part of her husband's family. Mm-hmm. She moved from one family to another. And that meant that she would take care of her husband's parents in their old age rather than her own. Now, traditionally, she would not be supporting them. She would not be earning, but she would be doing the kind of elder care that daughters still do today. And so families had no expectation for material support from their daughters, only from their sons. And of course, there was no Social Security. So this created a strong incentive for sons rather than daughters. And then the second basic reason that boys were preferred over girls was that the cost of a wedding and a dowry in the countries where dowry is practiced. And that cost can add up to, easily add up to 2 years, 3 years of family income. Mm. So having a daughter was an economic disaster. You can imagine that you either are going to pay for a wedding and provide a dowry maybe 15 to 18 years down the road when you're slowing down and thinking about retirement, or your son is going to marry and you're going to, you don't have to pay for a wedding and you will receive a dowry. Just when you're beginning to think about your own old age and retirement. So having a child was sort of a roulette game, and having a girl was an economic disaster. Having a boy was an economic boon. And one thing that many people don't realize is that the dowry is not a one-time gift. In the West, in the 19th century, when wealthy European women were married with dowries, the dowry was a one-time gift. But in Asia, the dowry was an ongoing stream of gifts from the parents of the bride to the parents of the groom. So it was economic devastation over a long period of time. And so obviously, for this reason, parents didn't want to have daughters. Even today, the dowry is widely, widely practiced. It has been banned in India for decades, but It's still practiced. People will say, well, I didn't pay a dowry, but we provided some gifts. Or, well, we didn't want our daughter to be mistreated, so we provided some gifts. It's dowry.
Yes.
But even today, in India and Bangladesh now practices dowry, and Pakistan and other countries where this occurs, 60% of families will go into debt in order to pay for a wedding and pay the dowry. And since many of them, most of them, don't have access to loans from banks, they go to loan sharks. And so they're paying horrendous rates of interest on the money they own. And all of this creates a disincentive to have girls. So this is why we believe that educating girls is the best long-term strategy to deal with the problem. Because an educated girl will provide for her family. She can earn money. She can be economically useful and bring income to the family and help support her parents in their old age.
So may I ask you, Beverly, and thank you for that, because you're correcting what my original question was, and I'm grateful for that, because we need to have educated girls. But is there a challenge also that there is lack of education opportunities for girls in these countries? Obviously, if they're immediately thought of as second-class citizens or as a commodity, how are they finding education? How are they getting the education if there is lack of teachers or the resources available to them? Or is that part of what you're doing with the Gender Side Awareness Project, is to help to bring educational facilities to these impoverished areas?
Let me take that question in pieces. To answer your first point, there is definitely a gender gap in education. It is slowly being addressed. I am thankful that today almost all girls go to primary school. That's a huge improvement over the situation 20 years ago. Where the real gap appears is in secondary school. And that secondary school is just a term that means what includes what we would call middle school and high school. And that gap appears for several reasons. First of all, in many countries, there are schools for boys and schools for girls, especially during adolescence. They want to keep the boys and the girls separate because these societies are very traditional. And there's an enormous gap in the quality of education for boys versus girls in the public schools. So that's one reason for the gender gap. A second reason is that girls are enrolled in secondary school, but they're not attending. Measuring attendance is much more difficult than measuring enrollment. Lots of countries will require girls to be enrolled, but the girls don't actually attend. Mm-hmm. And the reasons for their not attending have to do with the fact that they are becoming young women. They're adolescents. They're going through puberty. They begin to menstruate. And many public schools do not have bathrooms. They don't have enclosed bathrooms, and there is no place where the girls can privately manage their monthly cycles. And the result is that they stay home for 1 week each month, and they fall farther and farther behind until they just drop out. And then the schools don't have bathrooms because they don't have running water. They don't have the plumbing for that.
So correct me if I'm wrong also, Beverly, but it's also because there's the stigma of being unclean when someone is having their menstrual cycle.
That also operates in some of these countries. That is true. In Nepal, for example, quite commonly, girls and women are still banished to menstruation huts when they're having their periods. And that is, it's exactly that. It's a hut outside the home. It has no heating. It has, it's, you know, just a little shack with the dirt floor. And that's where they sleep and where they study during the week or so that they're having their periods.
And it's so unimaginable because they're being punished for being human.
Yes.
They're being
yes.
punished for the potential of bringing life into this planet. It's just madness.
It's hard to believe that that thinking still persists, but that thinking is very, very strong. Mm-hmm. You know, we saw just a week ago that when two women of menstruating age entered a temple in Kerala in India, Kerala province, the state of Kerala in India, protests erupted. I can tell you that I spoke with the director of our education partner in Nepal, and he has tried very hard to educate the people about this and lead them to see it as menstruation is something that's purely biological and reproductive, but he would be told stories such as, well, I brushed up against my daughter when she was menstruating, and then 2 days later, my father was diagnosed with a cancer. So they're very superstitious about the connection between this contact and other horrible things that might happen. A traditional folk belief is that a tiger will appear, or that the head of the male head of the household will die. And it's very hard to break down these superstitions. But this inability to manage menstruation is a huge factor in keeping adolescent girls out of school. Another one is the risk involved in traveling to school. Often these girls have to travel long distances to get to school, and it's dangerous. Mm-hmm. Now that they are becoming young women, they are at great risk for being assaulted or raped en route. And not only is that a tragedy for them personally, but it makes them, it greatly reduces their value as potential brides. If a girl is raped, or even if she is observed using the bathroom and she's partially exposed, there's great shame attached to that. And that means that she will get a much less desirable husband. If she had a shot at a husband who had some education and some earning potential and could possibly offer her a higher quality of life, that will be lost. And then she might have to marry somebody like an ex-convict. So parents are terrified that their daughters will be compromised in this way, and they prefer to keep them at home.
You know, as you're saying all of this, what is just so mind-boggling to me, and perhaps this is something that you talk about and or we need to talk about, is how do we bring together kind, loving, educated men to begin to speak about how do we begin to protect women? How do they help to take a stand against these patriarchal ways that are so violent and so without rational thinking? And I understand what you're speaking about, that this is long traditions, but traditions, unfortunately, are often predicated on misinformation. And how do we begin to not only educate the girls, but educate the men about, you know, what does it mean to be half of humanity?
You are asking the $10 million question. This is a very tough problem because it may surprise you to learn that in India, it is the most educated, most affluent, wealthiest elites who kill off their daughters the most aggressively through sex selective abortion. So it's very easy to say that this devaluation of women and girls is just a matter of poverty and ignorance, and that education will solve the problem. Unfortunately, you know, doctors, lawyers, engineers, politicians in India are practicing this very aggressively. There is very, very strong son preference in this class.
And that's exactly, Beverly, what I'm speaking about, is because of the fact that clearly there are people in positions of authority that absolutely know that this is happening. That I think that if it was left to a small village, what keeps coming back to my mind is indigenous cultures in the Americas. There was such a level of awareness that if there was no, if there was no respect given to the entire tribe, that individual who was willing to be harmful was removed from the village, not you know, protected within the village.
That's right. That's right. And this is a very tough conversation to have. I have mentioned India, but it is by no means limited to India. It's because every family is implicated. Yes. Every middle and upper class family is implicated in this, that it is so hard to talk about it. It's in the news. There have been awareness campaigns on the part of the Indian government. There's a very well-known one right now called Betty Bachao, Betty Padao, Save a Girl, Educate a Girl. But in social settings, people absolutely do not talk about this because everyone is doing it.
Well, I think that is historically true, as we see in so many facets of our world, is that, you know, in every culture, whether that is in Catholicism, where it's no, but don't speak about pedophilia, or no, and don't speak about what's happening. But if we all understand, we are all complicit if we do nothing. So we have to get over our individual shame, because we are all to blame if we do nothing.
So, that's right.
You know, I think that's that right. What's so important is I think about the world wars. You know, how many people knew that crimes were happening against people all over the globe? And if you don't know, you cannot pretend, or if you know, you cannot pretend that you don't know truly. You can have the facade of ignorance, but willful ignorance does not mean you don't know. It means you're choosing to ignore. Such a great difference in how we need to educate ourselves about how are we all complicit.
That's right. And you bear moral responsibility if you know and you don't speak up. It's not good enough just to say, well, I don't do that, so it's not my problem. It is your problem. You're a witness to an injustice and you're not addressing it. One of my hopes is that the diasporas from all of these countries can be really, really effective in changing attitudes back home. We have huge communities here in the United States from all of these affected countries, and attitudes do change within a couple of generations. Many immigrant families, many immigrant families brought son preference with them, And in the first generation of children, you would see a somewhat distorted sex ratio. But that problem corrects itself very, very quickly. And in the generation after that, the sex ratio goes back to normal and the attitudes have become very Western. And this diaspora, this community has a lot of influence on the community back home. You know, these South Asians and East Asians and African Americans, Africans who immigrated here recently, they travel back home frequently and they have their more westernized ideas, or I even hate to use that term, modern, progressive, egalitarian, I'm not sure what the correct term would be. And they do command respect back home because they came to this country and they succeeded. They tended to be the better educated in the first place. That's how they got here, was by means of their education. Some of them did have more progressive ideas, and those can be communicated back to the home country. I think that is a powerful tool for change.
Well, that was something I was just thinking about, Beverly, as you're saying that, and thank you for that. But we have to recognize that we are a global society. There is no such thing as one people really exclusively living only in one area, or very few instances of that, you know, and so many people are global movers. And the thing that I think that we have to look at is, what does it mean to be better educated? I mean, does it mean that you have, accolades after your name? Or does it mean that you're a human who has a moral responsibility to humanity itself? I mean, what are we defining education? You know,
that's exactly right. We tend, you know, for immigration purposes, it's viewed as vocational education, mm-hmm. that will enable you to support yourself in this country. Many countries abroad have the European educational system where you do not do a liberal arts education in college. You graduate from high school with a baccalaureate and then go immediately into university training that is very specialized toward engineering or medicine or law, mm-hmm. or computer science. And all of those humanities subjects just vanish. And that's part of the problem, is that these people are highly educated technically, but not in terms of the humanities and the liberal arts and social studies.
Well, and so the term the humanities is a very powerful phrase. I mean, because it is the care of all humans in its truest sense. Because as you were saying, if so many of these people are quote unquote highly educated, and yet they're the ones who are perpetrating these things, what part of their education system is broken? And what part of their education system is setting this up for repeated, you know, cultural, just moving it through the culture again and again and again and again. You know, unfortunately, our time is getting very short, as it always goes by so quickly. So, Beverly, how can people help? How can people? Well, first of all, I'd love to see what we could do to bring it to Michigan, to bring this exhibition to Michigan, because it's so moving. And I'll be in touch with you about that if I can privately. But well, how can people help?
Again, I think the most effective strategy is to educate these at-risk girls to make sure they're attending school, not simply enrolled in school, and to make sure that they're receiving a quality education. Unfortunately, in the developing world, teachers often just don't show up. You know, teacher absentee rates can be as high as 50% in some of these schools, especially the girls' schools. The girls' schools will not have the math and physics teachers, you know, and the science labs and some of the amenities that might be available in the boys' schools, the computer labs.
Well, maybe just making a donation to you would be helpful, but we're running out of time. So if people could go to Gendercide Awareness Project, which is GENDAP.org, take a look at what they have, take a look at the work that they're doing. It is so important. And the impact that you are bringing to our world and this horrible information that must be seen. I cannot thank you enough, Beverly, for all that you're doing and I want to make one really important statement about your work as an artist, because you said that it was impractical. There's nothing impractical about this exhibition that you have created. And, you know, it's the use of the right side of the human brain that helps us to begin to be intuitive, to be insightful, to be aware, to be honest. And then the left side of the brain has to be redirected on how to make things work. So I want to thank you for all that you do. My guest has been Beverly Hill, the president and founder of Gendercide Awareness Project. My name is Elaine Grohman for Going Beyond Medicine on Empower Radio. Let's make 2019 a year where we make all of these atrocities front and center, so we cannot pretend it isn't happening anymore.